Does your antiperspirant keep you dry all day? Dove Men Plus Care Dry Spray goes on instantly dry for a cleaner feel and offers 48 hours sweat and odor protection. Let me repeat that. 48 hours of sweat and odor protection. Use it and don't even think about it. Also, Dove Men Dry Spray contains Dove's unique one-quarter moisturizing cream that helps protect your skin. Try Dove Men Plus Care Dry Spray. Goes on dry, clean feel all day.
This is the Rich Eisen Show.
Brady and Gronk to come to the Raiders. And at the last minute, Gruden blew the deal up.
Live from the Rich Eisen Show studio in Los Angeles.
I was sitting there thinking, you're sticking with that mother...
Earlier on the show, senior writer for the MMQB, Albert Breer, Fox Sports rules analyst, Mike Pereira, co-host of The Room, Jordan Palmer. Coming up, co-creator of the AMC series, Better Call Saul, Vince Gilligan. And now, it's Rich Eisen.
Yes, it is. Can confirm. Right here on the Rich Eisen Show, I am sitting here on our set here on YouTube, as well as our terrestrial radio network, coast to coast. We say hello to our Odyssey listeners and then those who are listening on our podcast version, whenever you darn well please, because it is your God-given right to do that sort of thing right here on this very busy Monday. We say hello to all everyone out there, and we are thrilled to have here in studio, once again, the very first in-studio guest in the history of this program, Chris Brockman. We were 0 days old
when
this man first stopped by in that October in 2014. And now he is here on a very busy day in the middle of an incredible stretch, just 1 week after the finale of an incredible television show, Better Call Saul. The writer, director, and co-creator of that show, as well as the creator of Breaking Bad, Vince Gilligan, here on the program. Good to see you here, Vince.
Great to see you, Rich.
Yes, yes, I agree. Round of applause for sure. Let's get into it here. How did you find the finale? What is the reaction to your work, Vince, is what?
It seems, anecdotally, it seems really good. I never looked that stuff up. It's like a rabbit hole you would disappear down.
Right.
I feel like. But I hear people seem to like it, so I'm very happy about that.
Well, as you might imagine, people have opinions. our opinion here is I thought it was fantastic. And I'm not just saying that because you're sitting here. Wow. I said it with you outside of the room as well.
Well, thank you.
How long did you and Peter Gould and the rest of your staff and the rest of your team and the rest of your co-creator, Peter Gould, how long in advance did you know about the finale that you mapped it out?
We were lucky. We had about 13 months in the writer's room.
Right.
I think is what it was. We had the longest time we've ever had. Maybe it was more. Partly because of COVID, partly because it takes us forever to figure this stuff out. But we didn't know the ending at the beginning of that 13 months. We were kind of figuring it out as we went, as always. So probably, I don't know, a couple months before we wrote that last one, we had it figured out. A couple of weeks, maybe.
A couple of weeks,
well,
huh?
Well, all the little details, I guess. It takes a while to figure all this stuff out.
Well, and again, I just can kind of give a little heads up, and you were kind enough in the back of, in our back green room to give me the green light as well. You consider a week is enough of time period to start talking about spoilers? Are you fine with that?
I guess anybody who's watching who hasn't seen it yet, just maybe, well, I don't want to tell anybody
tell
to tune out.
To turn on, but no, I understand if they do. I understand if they would. And then, you know, then return to this conversation later on, because I just thought the ending was perfect.
Because
there's, you know, ways that either A, he would completely get away with it, or B, he would wind up like Walter White, spoiler alert, dead on a floor.
Right.
But him being incarcerated and having to pay his debt to society, which he personally worsened because he copped to it himself. Because I guess he wanted to impress Kim Wexler. Is that what he wanted
to do? I think he wanted to atone. I think there's a certain amount of redemption. The way we saw it is a little bit of Dickens' A Christmas Carol. There's a little bit of redemption in there, self-redemption. And I think he wanted to atone for his guilt, and he wanted to basically apologize. He did it in a very operatic way that wound up, spoiler alert, he was going to get 7 years in the penitentiary. Instead, he gets 86.
But right.
But he seems to be doing okay at the end. He's, you know, he's doing the same job he was doing at the Cinnabon You know,
that's for, right. Yeah, so, you saw the way that the dough was being kneaded by the
same machine and everything. So, yeah.
And that's obviously purposeful that you would do that sort of
thing.
Well,
it's one of those ironic things that he winds up doing the same job in the federal pen in Colorado that he was doing at the Cinnabon in Omaha.
Can you walk me through what were some of the other ideas that you had but discarded for the end of the show?
I wish I had some good ones for you, Rich. You talk about everything, but I had some good ones for you for Breaking Bad.
Right.
But I don't remember that many this time around. It just felt like he needed to go to prison. Walter White died. Jesse Pinkman rode off into the sunset, went to Alaska, and hopefully he got away with it. That's the guy that got away. Here's hoping. Knock on wood. Jimmy really felt like he needed to go to prison because he's a lawyer. That felt like the most proper way to the legal aspect of it, going into the system felt right. So I can't really remember any other good ones.
Chris, you have a
Vince. Was there any thought of having him take the deal, do the seven, and be done with it?
You know what? It actually felt better.
That was kind of such a fun scene of him in front of the FBI and negotiating. Yeah. And, hey, I got this. I got this. Yeah. Wait a minute. I want the ice cream. Yeah. Like, was there any thought of that being the end?
No, because we wanted to prove he could do it. We really wanted to prove he was the best lawyer and was able to basically – win in with this amazing bunch of legal talent, arrayed against him. He was nonetheless able to pull this off. So once we proved to the audience and he proved himself, he could beat all these other guys, these heavy hitters at their own legal game. Then we felt like, he's kind of got a, I don't know. It sounds very, Judeo-Christian, morality, whatever. But, it just felt like he kind of had to pay for his sins.
Yeah, I thought it was cool that he pointed out that the guy he was going up against, the FBI prosecutor, had never lost. I feel like that was kind of an important note there. And then he's like, well, watch this. Watch what I'm about to do.
Yeah, Vince Gilligan here on the Rich Eisen Show. And I appreciate you bearing with me as I just suddenly lost my voice right there, right here on the Rich Eisen Show. So, you didn't consider killing him off? You didn't. That wasn't an idea that you had.
Nah,
that you thought.
I don't know that anybody wants to see that. And our character of Lalo always called him La Cucaracha. He's the cockroach.
The cockroach, yeah.
And what does a cockroach do? A cockroach survives. And it felt like it was appropriate that he lived.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Lalo because I think that's one of the many, many brilliant aspects of Better Call Saul is the characters you created just for this show. Just for this show. And Lalo Salamanca is one of the, he was just Tony Dalton, the actor, right?
Tony Dalton.
He was just remarkable. And obviously Kim Wexler, that you created Kim. And then one of the aspects about Better Call Saul that I was wondering how you would finish it up was, did she exist during the Breaking Bad era? Like, was she on the planet? Did she exist?
Yeah.
And she did. She absolutely did.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, why did you choose those paths for the Kim Wexler character?
We didn't
want
to kill her off either. We love Ray Seahorn. She is just the sweetest, funniest, just most charming person in real life. She's such a wonderful actor. And she's just fantastic. It would have, and it was funny. Peter and I would get questions for years on end.
Yes.
You're not going to kill off Kim. You're not going to kill her off. And we'd go, well, you just have to watch. And we had no intention ever of killing her off.
Well, you had to leave it open-ended, right?
Yeah, yeah. But you don't want to ruin anything for people. So we were a little bit, we were coy to the point of being a little bit, a little bit sadistic, maybe.
Well, you see, it was just, for those who know Breaking Bad, and obviously that's most everyone that's watching Better Call Saul, you're wondering how somebody who is so sweet on Kim Wexler and is somebody whose moral compass always was found deep within the garbage, in his world, because of the way he felt about her and the way she kind of, before she started, acting in with him, that how that guy could be Saul Goodman.
Yeah.
Watching Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, I mean, it it kind of, you know, tore him apart in a way. Where he might have just thrown himself into the dark side completely? Is that a fair way of looking at it?
Very fair, very astute way of looking at it. He, to us, he became Saul Goodman as a sort of an F you to you know, just, oh, so you won't be with me, so you know, we're bad together, we're bad for the universe, we're bad for all the people around us. I'll show you bad. And it was just this self-defeating weird caricature that he became. He kind of hardened into this legal caricature, and that was, it took us forever to figure that out. Once we finally figured that out, the question Peter Gould would always ask, which was a great question, is he would say at the beginning of the run of the series, he would say, what is the problem that becoming Saul Goodman solves? And it was a twofold answer, I guess. It was, if you build this armor around you, if you're this legal caricature, I keep calling him, then you don't feel anymore. You're not worried about things. You're happy-go-lucky, and nothing really matters. So it's kind of an armor, and it's also kind of a screw you to the world. And you know, when we realized we don't want to see this guy end like this. We want to see him redeem himself, and that's where the ending comes from, really.
Yeah, and then why shoot the current day in black and white? Why'd you make that decision?
We wanted something that we love black and white. Peter used to teach, was a film professor at USC Film School,
yes.
And I'm a film geek. We're both film geeks, and we both love old film noirs. So black and white just looks good to us. Maybe not everybody, but we're old school, and we love it. And also, it was a way of quickly differentiating the past from the present. The past was in color, Jimmy, and then he becomes Saul Goodman, and then the present is Gene Takovic, the character that he becomes, the guy that works in Omaha at the Cinnabon.
Right, yeah. And just becomes a guy who slips back into who he was, slipping Jimmy one more time.
Exactly.
He gets right back into that.
Yeah.
Why did he get back in, like, what I guess is the reason why, because Kim rejected him on his birthday when he calls him from the payphone? Like, why do you think he...
He's very self-destructive. I think it's a lot of that, is what you just said. And he's just got this itch that he just can't scratch. He just, you know, and by the way, nothing wrong with working at a Cinnabon in real life. And
but no,
all
no,
the
I
folks, no, I know you're not saying it. I'm saying to all the folks, like, hey, why does my job suck so bad? It does.
Right.
It's not, it doesn't. But he's just this guy who really, you know, the old expression in Heat, you know, the juice is worth the squeeze.
Right.
You know, he's in it for the juice, I guess. He's in it for the high he got from scamming, and also, yeah, at that last bit there, he's just angry at the world. He's angry at himself. He's angry at her. I think ultimately he's angry at himself, and he becomes very self-destructive. It's like he's trying to get caught in that second to last episode, I think.
I guess and it's interesting how he's trying to get caught, and then he gets caught breaking into a man's house who has cancer.
Yeah.
And the line he says to one of his accomplices who refused to do that job because the guy had cancer, he goes, what, an a-hole?
Yeah.
Guy with cancer can't be an a-hole.
Yeah, yeah.
And for all the Breaking Bad fans, it's just like, what a line.
Yeah.
That basically his history with Walter White causes him to have such an animus against this poor guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what causes him to get caught.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you think about that? I know that's a grand question. Just as like, how do you think about that?
Yeah,
how did you come up with that?
God
sort
bless
of stuff,
you for
man?
Absolutely. I love that you dug it.
Oh, we're into it.
I know. I love it. I appreciate it, guys. And it's not the most interesting answer, but the truest answer is it takes a village. I mean, I didn't think all this stuff by myself. Half the time I'm in the room and everybody else is saying, what if this, what if that? And I'm like, yeah, and I'm a beat behind. But it's a group effort, and it takes a whole bunch of us, and it takes a lot of time. It took months and months. Luckily, Sony and AMC gave us that time, our studio and our network, and they allowed us Because, you know, back when I worked on network TV, it was great. I got to work on the X-Files for 7 years. I love that job. Mm-hmm. But you are running for your life. It's like, you know, it's like on the I Love Lucy and Lucy
she's
and Ethel
with the chocolates.
Yeah. And it's just, you're just putting out the best you can put out in that very finite time period. This was so luxurious, having all this time to, and then you just game it out. You say, what if we do this? And you think about it and you think about it. And then you say, 2 days later, you say, no, that's not going to work because of this. And you're trying to be a chess player. You're trying to game it out
right.
12, 20 moves in advance. Trouble for me is I'm not much of a chess player. But
Were you ever told by anybody, again, you've had such an amazing amount of success, maybe not, by anyone at AMC? Because the burn was really slow in the very beginning of your series, where I honestly thought it was going to be like a whole bunch of Breaking Bad people right off the bat. It was its own narrative. It was its own show, which is terrific, and it was great. And you had us at hello, and you kept us all the way through all those years. But did you ever get anybody saying, where's the Breaking Bad in this thing? Did that ever come across your...
These guys have been great to work for. I got to say, I'm not just saying it because, you know, it's what you do on TV, you know, but they really were a great bunch of guys. They really didn't push us. And I've been pushed before in the past on shows and you know. And it's a better feeling when they let you, you know, they let you do your thing. And then the flip side of that is you can't complain afterward when it doesn't work. Like, let us do what we wanted.
So then why did you do it that way?
It just felt right. It just felt like the way to go. And it, you know, and I think a lot of people did tune out. I hear a lot of people saying, it was too slow. It started off too slow. And I think you just nailed it what it was. There wasn't enough Breaking Bad in it from the get-go. And we didn't sit down and write out a show Bible and say, here's what we're not going to do. We're not going to have Breaking Bad in there. We're going to make it slow. It's more organic than that. You just sort of sit down and you say, who is this guy right now? He's this hard charging young wannabe. I mean, he's a lawyer, but he wants to have success. He's scrappy. He's an underdog. You know, you just sort of, the story takes you where it takes you, and the chips fall where they may. And in this case, luckily, nobody pushed us that hard at AMC or Sony to make it go faster.
Is it true the first original idea was half-hour comedy, not an hour?
Yeah, we did. We talked about there was a show. I'm getting the name wrong. What was it? Dr. Katz. There was an animated.
It
was a really funny show. Uh-huh. Basically, comedians coming on talking to a psychiatrist about their problems. We thought very derivative of that excellent show. We were saying, why can't it be done, you know, not animated, but why can't it be, you know, people walk into Saul Goodman's, you know, iconic office, and we could get a bunch of comics. We could get, you know, all these great folks coming in with their legal issue. And we literally talked about that for a week or two, Peter and I.
Really?
And, yeah, we did. Because we sold this thing. This is like people out there, you know, scrapping, trying to get a show sold. They're like, God, I hate this story. You know, they're thinking, watching this, but I don't blame them. But it was when Breaking Bad ended, we were lucky. We could write our own ticket, particularly if you know, what we wanted to do next had to do with that world. And we said, yeah, let's do Better Call Saul. And everybody said, great. And then Peter and I, once we signed on the dotted line, we thought, oh, man, what are we doing now? What is this show?
Well, I remember, you were kind enough to Vince Gilligan here on the Rich Eisen Show, our first in-studio guest when we first turned the lights on in the studio. And you had just come, Chris, right? Didn't you say you had just come from the writer's room, right?
Come from season one writer's room.
Right, of Better Call Saul.
Yeah. It was about a 30-minute interview, turned into 90.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty much what you were doing. Yeah. And so, you know, I totally understand why, you know, you would be able to bat around some ideas, but clearly I think you landed on the right one in that this was the one character, right? Like, was it another character that you were thinking of maybe going, or was it always Saul from the very beginning? It was Odenkirk, it was Saul, and that was it from the beginning.
Yeah, you know what it was? We weren't really thinking of a spinoff. It's just, it was so much fun. I think the very first time anyone floated the idea, it was one of our crew people on the set, and it was probably only... It was in Breaking Bad. It was maybe only an episode or two after Saul had first appeared. It might have been in season two of Breaking Bad. And one of our crew folks, one of our grips or gaffers, said, you know, when you guys are doing the Saul Goodman spinoff, you really need to. And everybody laughed. We all laughed. But the joke became, it's kind of planted a seed in our heads, and we thought, you know, that would be fun to do a spinoff. We weren't really thinking, it wasn't this logistical kind of, gee, what we need to do next is spin somebody off. Who do we pick? It kind of naturally grew from wanting to keep the crew together, thinking Bob's character is just fun to write. He's just plain fun, you know, and it really kind of sprung from that kind of a, you know, very relaxed and nobody was thinking that far ahead. It was that disorganized a beginning.
Really. Well, I mean, two things leap to mind. Number one, because that allows you to have as many characters from the Breaking Bad world if you set it when you set it, which is behind the, you know, back story leading up to the Breaking Bad world, and then have some black and white about what happens to him once he, now that he is on the run under a new identity. Just brilliant that you could do that. And then number two is Bryan Cranston came on the show a few years ago to promote his book, A Life in Parts.
Yeah.
And we talked to him about the character Tim Whatley, who he played the dentist. On Seinfeld.
Yeah.
And the scene where he took a hit of the laughing gas himself before administering it to Jerry.
Right.
And that was an ad lib that he did, suggested to him by a member of the crew, similar to what you just said.
Wow.
Yes, he told that story.
Like the lighting guy or something.
Yeah. So somebody suggests, you know what would be funny is you're the dentist, you take a hit of it yourself. And he's like, okay, I'll do that.
Yeah.
And then he said he did that and the whole crew broke up. And then he looked at the lighting guy and the lighting guy goes, you know, like, hey. And he used a phrase that we use here all the time, best idea wins.
Oh, yeah.
He uses that. We use that phrase all the time.
Yeah.
It's amazing that's how Better Call Saul first got planted in your brain.
It is. And by the way, the funniest line we ever had on Breaking Bad came from one of our grips.
Which is what?
To me, my favorite. Okay. Everyone's got a favorite. But it was an episode called 4 Days Out. It was Walt and Jesse are cooked, did this marathon cook in their RV. And now the battery's dead in their RV. They're 30 miles from nowhere. They're dying. They're dehydrating. They've run out of water.
Yes.
And Jesse says, come on, you're a scientist. You got to figure this out. We got these spare parts. You could build a dune buggy or you could build a robot. And Walt says, I forget some of the dialogue, but Walt winds up saying, you gave me the idea. And in the original script, you gave me the idea. We're going to build a battery and we're going to. And we had finished the day. We had wrapped for the day.
Oh boy!
And one of the grips said, you know, would it be funny if you said you gave me the idea yourself? And Jesse goes, a robot? And it made everybody laugh on the set. And talk about a group effort. Not only did this wonderful crewman come up with this line, but Michelle McLaren, our director of that episode, looked around and said, "We got to get that."
Turn the machines back on.
Literally. Kind of fibbed, all right, flat out lied to our producer. Said we had an issue. We had a hair in the gate. Luckily back then we were shooting film.
That's
you
right.
Could get away with that. We had a hair in the gate.
No, you can't.
Now they're on to you now.
Great,
we got a hair in the gate. Oh crap, we got to do that last one. And he did the line. It's in the episode. My personal favorite line in the whole series.
Best idea wins.
Yeah, yeah. And it's
Cranston said that. I'll never forget that line.
And that's the way it should be. And it's not always that. I mean. Not every show is that way. Sometimes it's kind of rigid, and sometimes you know, showrunner says, "Nah, it's got to be my way." And I always think, "Poor you. That's like that's you are missing out on so much greatness by not listening to your crew, to the people around you. They're full of great ideas." And best ideas should always win, I think.
I love it. Vince Gilligan here on the Rich Eisen Show. Let's take a break. When we come back here, we're gonna on the YouTube, we're gonna show a clip. Of Better Call Saul from the second to last episode, which you wrote and directed. It's brilliant. And then we'll talk a little bit more, and then we'll take some people's phone calls after Vince takes off. We're back here in a moment, right here on The Rich Eisen Show. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. That's true when your business is growing fast, and even more true when there's a lot of uncertainty. Inflation is running rampant, supply chains are clogged, and the labor market is tight. What does that mean for margins? Well, not every business is in the dark. Over 31,000 businesses know their numbers because they use NetSuite by Oracle, the number one cloud financial system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control of your financials, planning, budgeting, and of course, inventory, so you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. NetSuite helps you identify rising costs as well, helps you automate your manual business processes and see where to save your money. Know your numbers, know your business, and get to know how NetSuite can be the source of truth for your entire company. Right now, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/richpod right now. netsuite.com/richpod. It's netsuite.com/richpod. And again, we're back here in our terrestrial radio outfit talking to Vince Gilligan about the scene where Ray Sehorn is finally realizing what Kim Lex is. I mean, talk about, she was just wound tight. Even her hair was wound tight. You know, her hairstyle those years just wound tight. And and that tight ponytail, you know. Yeah. And so here she is now letting it all out. Yeah. And I just love the way that she's just sitting there and you could see like she's just thinking of it, shaking her head as you sometimes think of, I can't believe I did that. Like that's the international symbol of, I can't believe this happened.
Exactly.
And then it just, boom, comes out of her crying hysterically.
And it's, I mean, it's ultimately a good thing. It's cathartic. It's like, and we had that discussion. She works so hard and she makes it look so easy, but all the greats make it look easy, but I think most of the greats, they're really, you don't see the blood, sweat and tears. And she was thinking about it and writing notes about it and working on it for days and weeks leading up to it. We talked a lot about it. And I said, you know, it's sadness. It's just this great well of regret and despair, but it's also kind of cathartic. It also feels kind of good to let it out. And I think you see both of that and both those emotions in that scene.
Spectacular.
Yeah.
Just spectacular. Yeah, dare you make her do it a second time?
You mentioned not ever wanting to kill off Kim's character. Yeah. Thank you for that. I don't think we would have been able to handle it. But one person who didn't make it out was Howard Hamlin. Did you always have this end in sight for Howard?
Patrick Fabian's been on here this show multiple times, by the way.
It was going to be at the hands of Lalo. Was it always going to be like that?
You know, you guys would be amazed. Everybody would be amazed how... Because, you know, I take it as the highest compliment. You guys ask questions like that. Yeah. You're like, oh, and you must have had that figured out way in advance. The beginning of it all, Howard Hamlin was the bad guy. And that was our intention. When I'm talking at the beginning of season one, he was the bad guy. He seemed like the obvious choice for bad guy. This good-looking, handsome, you know, pulled together, always everything, you know, you never a hair out of place.
With the namaste license plate.
Yeah, and you're just
otherwise.
Like,
you're, tie bar.
Yeah, you're just, the pump is primed for you to hate this guy. And then we realized, wait a minute, the bad guy, the more interesting bad guy is Chuck McGill, played by the amazing Michael McKean.
Right.
And have him be the bad guy, Jimmy's own brother.
Right.
So you figure this stuff out as you go, I guess is the short answer. And I don't know when we came up with him dying, but it felt like if Kim and Jimmy are really sticking it to Howard, there needs to be some consequence they don't see coming. That's kind of the way you kind of do the calculus. When
I did scream out loud. I didn't see it coming.
Me too.
That was rough.
I didn't see it coming either. Yeah. I did not see it coming either. And again, Ray had so much of her character doing some bad stuff and bad stuff happening for her to start thinking about it in her head. I'd love to get into her process. That really was unbelievable.
Vince, she'd be great on this show.
Anybody from your world is welcome here. That's for sure. Vince Gilligan here. A few more minutes left with the co-creator and writer and director of Better Call Saul. All right, let's get into it. So you got how many? It looked like you got a couple days with Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul.
Yeah, we got a couple days with them.
Did you only got a couple scenes out of them? I mean, one together and then one separate. Why did you have Aaron Paul connect with Kim? What was that? Because you could have. Yeah. You could have connected any dots you wanted, and these are the dots that you connected. Yeah. What do you got for me on that front?
I don't have a great answer other than it just felt good. It just felt right. And I just love those two. And both of those characters on their individual shows, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, they were characters we didn't realize when we hired them both respectively for the both shows. We didn't realize how important they were going to be to both of their individual series. We didn't know, I've told this story many times, but Jesse Pinkman, we were going to kill him off at the end of season one. And season one was only going to be 9 episodes, Breaking Bad. And we were going to kill him off because I figured, dumbly that you know he will have fulfilled his utility to the plot. He would have gotten Walter White into this world of criminality, and then once that was done, you don't need him anymore. That was so short-sighted. And then, of course, he winds up being, you know, integrally important to Breaking Bad. And the same goes for Ray's character, Kim Wexler. She's just, there wouldn't be, I don't think we would have had as much love, as many viewers, as much ink written about the show if it weren't for this character of Ray. She's just fantastic. And so just seeing those two together, the both number two on the call sheet, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, there it is outside of Saul Goodman's office sharing smoke.
Yeah. I feel so bad that night.
Was it really pouring?
It wasn't pouring. Okay. That's all fake rain, courtesy of Werner Hanlein, our wonderful special effects genius. But it was miserable. It's just as miserable as a real thing to shoot in, I can tell you that.
Sure.
But it was months ahead of when the whole rest of the script was written, because it was the small window we had to get Aaron Paul. And he was such a trooper. Just peeing down rain, all fake rain, but still peeing down rain all night. It's cold. And he does not smoke. I think he used to in real life. But I said, you know, I got to have a reason for you two to be standing there talking as long as you are, because the vibe from her, rightly so, is that she's not going to spend a lot of time here talking with you. So
she just signed divorce papers.
Exactly.
She kind of wants to get out of there.
And he's kind of looking her up and down like, man, you're pretty milfy, you know. which she is.
Yeah.
He was smoking these clove cigarettes. And he was such a trooper. I didn't even know this until late in the night. He would do the scene. You do a great many takes, especially when, like me, you know, you're making people do it more than once. And he would go inside, and I think he might even have thrown up. He had such a migraine from these awful fake cigarettes. And he was such a trooper. I didn't even know it until my AD said, you know, do you have to do another one?
Yeah,
he's really
off.
Suffering. And he's the sweetest guy in the world.
Well, and then there's the scene where it's Walter White and Jesse Pinkman back together in the RV with Saul Goodman in there.
Yeah.
And the RV's not starting. And just the byplay between Jesse and Walter, it was just so delicious to see the two, the derision and the anger and, you know, the odd buddy aspect of it just back one more time with the RV not starting. Why'd you decide to utilize that moment?
Because
again, you only had a small window with these guys, and I just wanted to understand what your choices were with getting these guys back on screen.
I think in that case, and that episode was written and directed by Tom Schnaus, I think my oldest friend in the world, who I'm still in touch with on a regular basis, he and I met at NYU Film School, and he just crushed it, as he always does, writing and directing. That was a great episode. And I think we were thinking, you know, we need to see how quickly this character of Saul Goodman kind of takes charge of this situation. You know, he's on his knees with a gun to his head. These guys are about to kill him, or at least they're threatening to. I don't know if they would have done it. And then suddenly he turns things around, and it's feels by the end of the scene, you know, you two clowns work for me. And that felt like the right time to plant that flag. And having said that, the truth was more complicated. I think Saul Goodman did live in fear of Walter White, especially toward the end. I think everybody in that world did. But there was a time there where Saul is the consigliere who is kind of in charge of the operation and saying, why don't you, you know, do it this way, don't do that, and you'll get caught. And there wouldn't have been, as he says in that last episode of Better Call Saul, there wouldn't have been a Heisenberg without me. And I think there is some truth to that.
There's no question.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the scene in the finale where Walter White is there with Saul Goodman and they're, you know, on the process of going on the lam. And we all know Walter decides not to do that. And that's the way Breaking Bad winds up ending. The fact that the question about who Saul Goodman is deep down inside.
Yeah.
And Jimmy McGill and how he became Saul Goodman. And the question for this entire series was why? Why was he like this?
Yeah.
For Walter White to be given the line to reveal essentially what's going on, where Saul reveals about the slip in Jimmy story, and he turns to him and he says, so you've always been like this.
Yeah.
And I just was blown away. I'm like, that you guys build up to this slow burn to have Walter White deliver that line is unbelievable. And the shot that Peter set up from down below, he just walks into the frame and delivers that line.
Yeah.
It's so great, man. I'm getting goosebumps just even talking about it. You know, it's really, and again, I'm just wondering, like, did you specifically set this thing up to have Walter White deliver that line when it's all said and done? Because he reveals the answer at the very end.
You know, that Peter wrote that line in there, and Peter wrote and directed that episode. Yeah. And I, you know, we plot these things out together as a team of writers, but not every detail, not every granule in this you know, is a group effort. And I don't remember. Maybe we did talk about that in the writers' room, but it's just as likely, if not more likely, Peter just came up with that when he was writing it.
Yeah. It's brilliant. I mean, that's the answer.
Yeah,
like there's no escaping it. You've always been like this. So I guess before I let you go, Vince, is what is next? What can you tell me about what is next?
I want to keep. I better keep the pedal to the metal because I'm not getting any younger. And I kind of want to. I love this world of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, but I kind of feel like I gotta try something new. I gotta prove to myself I'm not, you know, kind of a one trick pony. So I've got a new project. Pitching it this week actually. And if it goes, it'll be a TV series. It has nothing to do with Breaking Bad, nothing to do with Better Call Saul. And it's not really, it does not center on an anti-hero. It centers more on someone who has got some issues, got some rough edges, but is essentially trying to be heroic. So I'm being a little coy.
No, I understand that, and I don't want to pin you down to something that you don't want to answer, but I am reading about, is it science fiction related?
And it is. To me, it's, yeah, and I grew up loving science fiction.
Well, I mean, you said X-Files for 7 years.
Yeah, and I would call this will appear when people watch it or read it, and they'll say it's science fiction. To me, it's more allegorical, but it'd be safe to say it's science fiction.
Okay, so then do you think we have seen the last of the Breaking Bad Saul world then, Vince?
You know, never say never. I don't have any, I mean, not a scintilla of plans to do anything else with any of that world right now as we record this. But, you know, if I get my ass handed to me with this new show.
Come on,
you know,
now.
Like, oh, man, you know, baby needs
return
a new,
to home base,
new mortgage.
Retreat? Come on, no. Come on now, man.
Kim Wexler, attorney at law. Come on.
She is.
Florida. She's starting to do it. She's doing all the stuff down there now. Yeah. Like, we can do this.
I mean, her bar license is not expired. That's the way she's going to be, I guess, going to visit Jimmy for a while.
Outback Steakhouses. I mean, come on.
Yeah, no. She's hanging out at the, you know,
Better Call Saul meets Raising Arizona. We pop them out of prison. I don't know. I mean,
we got such an embarrassment of riches when it comes to these characters. I mean, you know, Mike Ehrmantraut, Gustavo Fring. It'd be interesting to see more of what was happening with Lalo before, you know.
Okay.
I mean, but having said that, I don't know.
A prequel, a Lalo prequel. There's so many more seasons we could do.
I think you would have every fan that you have, and there are many of them. Lalo, that's
cartel world.
I think you would be all in on that. I mean, Lalo leading up because you're opening up the. Here I am. I'm pitching you now. I mean, the Salamanca world. Yeah. Obviously, the Fring world. You can go in any direction that you want right there.
By the way, he'd be great in his show. He's so charming. He's such a great. Tony Dalton is such a good guy.
My gosh.
And he is.
That
just,
smile has got all sorts of evil to it, you know? Yeah, I'm sure it might be warm in real life, but when Lalo showed those pearly whites, it was bad news usually for somebody. So
he was so smart and so confident the way Tony was, the way he played Lalo. Because, you know, he could literally, you know, that's a character that's so evil, so chaotically.
Where you're like twirling the mustache. Somebody's tied to the tracks.
Yeah. But he was so smart to play it so the reverse of that. He's just suave, the
most interesting man in the world,
He has no trouble killing people, as we've seen time and time again on the show. But he doesn't not enjoy it, but he's not cartoonish about it. He's just like, he's a guy you'd want to have a beer with, but God forbid you cross him. at all.
Yeah, you better pick up the tab.
Yeah.
You don't stiff him with the tab.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I could keep on asking you questions forever.
I know, me
forever,
too. I have so many questions. Like, just one lastly. So the only color in the black and white world was at the end with the flame. Like, obviously that's intentional, but what does that signify to you? Like, what was the kind of the meaning behind
that? To me, and we had a little color in the episode before when he's looking at himself you see looking at the laptop screen. Carol Burnett, by the way, we could talk another hour about Carol Burnett.
I wouldn't
even
bring her up.
Yeah, but she's the best. But to me, that's a good catch. The little bit of color in the end of the cigarette at the very last episode, to me, that's hope. That is hope. Not that he's necessarily going to get out of prison. Although I don't know if they keep you in for 86 years, really. Hopefully not. You know, with good behavior, maybe it's 30.
Him? Him with good behavior?
I don't know about him.
Good behavior.
Well, they just let out with the dude who shot Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, Hinckley's out. So if Hinckley's out, Saul's got some hope for him, huh?
They're talking about Sirhan. He might get out.
There we go.
Yeah. So, keep a happy thought. But to me, that's hope. Not necessarily that he'll get out, but that these two respect each other again. He always respected her, I think. She respects him. There's some love there. Yeah. It's going to be, hopefully, they get some visitation going on because, it's going to be tricky. But yeah, to me. And by the way, Carol Burnett. God, what an honor it was to work with her.
She's a fan of the show, and that's how
she was a fan of Breaking Bad. Holly and I got to know her and her husband Brian, dating back to, we've known her several years now. And then when this character came up, the opportunity to use this to have this character, I said to Peter and the writers, "What do you guys think about Carol?" And they said, "Oh my God, could we get her?" And thank goodness we did. We got her, and she is. It was a tough shoot, and she made everyone on the crew happy just by her very presence.
Yeah.
It was really tough with COVID, with Bob Odenkirk having his heart failure on the set, and it was, earlier in the season, and it was just a real hard slog to shoot this at the final season. And she just brightened everybody's life when she showed up, all the crew. She's just wonderful.
Well, I mean, if I told you when you came in here on our first day in 2014, hey, the season, your show's going to last damn near 10 years, and you're going to get Carol Burnett to finger Saul Goodman at the very end, you'd be like, what?
Hey, what?
But yeah, that's what happened.
We didn't see that coming.
Carol Burnett fingers Saul Goodman. That's what happened. Vince, you have always been so generous with your time. And again, I can't wait to see what you got cooked up next. We are all in.
Thank you, Rich. No question about that.
Thank you. Anytime. Stay in touch. Vince Gilligan, everybody check out Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad, all of it. If you have just watched this and you haven't watched it, we apologize. But check it all out again. It's as fresh as the first day you saw it. Thanks for being here, Vince Gilligan.
Thank you, Rich. Appreciate
back to wrap up the show in a moment. 844-204-RICH is the number to dial here on the program. Also later this week, Michael Mann, the director of Heat, now the author of the bestseller, number one on the New York Times bestseller novels list, Heat 2, the sequel. And they do a lot of what Breaking Bad did. They go back in time and flash forward or move the story from the present day on. Amazing. Danny DeVito in studio on Friday. Chrome Soft golf balls. I use them. You should as well. I'm just the caveman out there. Your breaking par confuses me. So I use the regular Chrome Soft. There is a type of Chrome Soft for your type of game. That's why it's amazing. That's why Callaway knows exactly what they're doing. The Chrome Soft's designed for the widest range of golfers. If you're a little bit better, looking for more workability, is the Chrome Soft X. The Chrome Soft XLS gives you a lower spin golf ball, longer shots, firmer feel, still high spin around the greens. Guess what? All of them are enhanced with precision technology, which uses design techniques and manufacturing specifications up to 1/1000th of an inch. That's what ensures they're the highest quality, most consistent, fastest golf balls possible. When you add it all up, it's so simple. Chrome Soft is better for the best, and it's better for everyone. Find out which Chrome Soft is right for you at CallawayGolf.com/ChromeSoft. You ready for tonight, TJ?
Tonight?
Marcel in Brooklyn, New York. You're here on the Rich Eisen Show. What's up, Marcel?
Hey, Rich. Good afternoon, my man. Happy New Yorker. Happy Rich Eisen Show. I've never been watched a show since 2014. You guys are rock.
Thanks, brother.
Yes. And tonight, the New York Mets and the New York Yankees are the Subway Series itself. Finally, I saw those Amazons and the Bronx Bombers coming together. You might be know. Oh, it's true. Do you know the New York Yankees and the New York Mets are true, true franchise teams? I think they did. What do you think about that?
Well, Marcel, I appreciate the call, and I appreciate your excitement and you tuning in here. I'm unfortunately totally confused about what he's referring to. All I know is that this is a big series. This is a big series.
Are you back with baseball now?
I started following it around the seventh inning yesterday.
Okay.
The Yankees are absolutely in the toilet.
Scherzer tonight.
And then DeGrom the next. So this is what's happening. Yeah, turn it on. Stop it. Stop it.
It's for TJ.
This is what's happening. The Mets are treating this series like the Yankees used to.
Ooh. Gotta win.
And again, like I said, Gerrit Cole got so upset over the weekend. I don't blame him. I don't blame him. There's not a lot of run support coming, so the Yankees had to make that – Gerrit Cole had to make that one run stand up, and it looked like he had no-hit stuff and then gave up four runs. Walking people, giving up big hits. And the Mets look like the World Series team of New York.
They really do.
Trying to temper my expectations.
Brother, you should just go with it.
Nah, I can't.
They're sending Scherzer and DeGrom against a team that's, you know – I heard Michael Kay told a story, gave a stat that the Yankees over the previous 10 games had averaged 1.9 runs per game and was a batting average of 174. The last time the Yankees had a 10-game stretch with numbers that bad in those categories was 1914.
Ooh.
That's how bad the Yankees have been playing lately. And now comes Scherzer and DeGrom.
Yeah, but as we know,
man, I'd sign for one run each of the next two nights right now.
Well, you probably only need two against DeGrom because for some reason the Mets cannot score runs with this man on the mound. It's
like Seager back in the day, like Gooden sometimes.
Yeah.
They've always had that, but this, guess what, man? You got the better team right now, that's for sure. That's for sure. Man. But it's big games tonight.
I feel
big
good.
Game tonight.
Big game. Good luck.
Big I mean, it's tonight. Not. It's probably a bigger game for you than for us, but...
I want to thank everybody for tuning in right here on the Rich Eisen Show on the radio. We're back here on YouTube tomorrow, youtube.com/Rich Eisen Show. Thomas Q. Jones will be in studio. We will see you all at that point in time. But we're still here on our YouTube stream. Thanks for playing the music, Mike.
I was kind of used to it. I get used to it. No, we do. Bottom of the hour, we don't do for radio.
Was that English?
I don't know what that was.
I play on that last radio.
I do want to say something here. I do want to say something here, and I don't know how long this is going to last, but as you know, we went away for COVID, you know, for a while, and we did some shows on our on Zoom for a couple weeks.
We did, right? We did a couple weeks.
And as you know, a ton of television outlets saw the Zooms and saw all that stuff. And I was genuinely concerned that the sports world would go away from premium coverage.
Yeah.
Or the regular coverage that you would normally assume for a broadcast or for a show would now be considered premium. Right? And so everyone would start doing things on the cheap or doing things on the Zoom. Mm-hmm. And I saw just last week, and as of this current statement right now, it is happening that the Portland Trailblazers are going to keep Kevin Calabro and the rest of their top-notch crew off the road calling games, road games, from their studio in Oregon.
Ugh.
Hmm.
And it's just like, was Paul Allen not the richest man on planet Earth? Did he what's up with that decision? The Trailblazers are just gonna in this day and age now not send their crew on the road, which by the way is exactly where all crews, all announcers get their best stuff. And they also know what's going on with the team because they're on the road with them. Everybody bonds together as a unit on the team, as well as those who cover the team. And those who cover the team get a lot of respect from the players because they're also going on the road too. Right. They're humping it on the road also. So, hey, Trailblazers, if you want to be considered a, you know, major franchise in this world where everybody's looking at Damian Lillard to wonder when he's going to tap out on you? And he says, I'm here for you, and I'm here for Portland, and I want to win here? What are you doing?
Yeah, TV and the radio crew.
What are they doing? Like,
that's going to be a delay as well, right?
No. But you guys, I do it all the time.
It doesn't matter. You're not there. You're not seeing the crowd. You're not seeing what's going on. And it's totally fine if it's during the pandemic and everyone was operating.
That was the only option.
Nobody's not operating. Nobody's operating this way anymore.
The crew does not all need to be there.
This is the NBA.
No, I get it. The announcers need to be on site. I get that because I do both. But the crew doesn't.
No, I understand. That I understand, and I understand. I totally understand.
I'm
talking about the announcers and those that need to be there as part of the crew with the announcers.
Of course.
You know, and so this is the NBA. There's 30 franchises in the NBA, and the Portland Trailblazers are one of them. And coast to coast, they are getting the, personally, I feel, raw deal that they can't build a winner there. And the fans are so diehard for this team. And Calabro is one of the best play-by-play guys ever. They're lucky to have him. I hope they reverse this.
For the real story behind some of wrestling's biggest moments, it's Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard and Conrad Thompson, too.
All-time Hogan opponents. Macho Man's got to be in the conversation. Where's Andre for you?
I've always said Andre was number one.
Wow.
Because even going back before, you know, Hulk Hogan was a babyface, Hulk and Andre were able to go in and headline at the New Orleans Superdome, at Shea Stadium in Japan. Wherever they went, that was an attraction.
Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.